We're on 1,000 planets and spreading out.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
To the Batmobile.
May the force be with you.
Who is that masked man?
Avengers, assemble.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Fantastic Forum. I'm Ulysses E. Campbell, I'm your host, and for the next hour, we are going to thrill and entertain you with news and information and interesting discussion and all sorts of other fun stuff dealing with those geeks that you have come to know and love. So, we're going to start the show. I do have just a little bit of news before we get into this thing here today, because today we're talking about music, and it's music from the various comic and science fiction and fantasy sort of productions, television shows, movies, all that, and that's what we're talking about. I've got some great panelists. They are very knowledgeable. I love them. You're going to love them too, but in the meantime, sad news from the world of comics this week, as writer and illustrator Rich Buckler died on Friday, May 19th. During a professional career that spanned over 45 years, Mr. Buckler drew virtually every major Marvel and DC character. Although he's perhaps best known for his work on the Fantastic Four in the mid-1970s and the creation of the character Deathlok, the cyborg, I really loved his stuff on the Black Panther in Jungle Action. Congratulations to the 2016 Nebula Award winners, which were presented in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, during the SFWA Nebula Conference. All the winners are listed on the Fantastic Forum Facebook page at facebook.com/Fantastic Forum, all one word. Also reported this week was that Zack Snyder is stepping down from post-production duties on the upcoming Justice League movie to deal with a family tragedy. Mr. Snyder's daughter, Autumn, died in March, and the filmmaker has opted to take some time off to be with his family during this time of grief. Snyder's wife, Deborah, is also a producer on the movie. Joss Whedon has been tapped to complete the post-production and keep the movie on schedule. And a milestone this week, as the Star Wars franchise celebrated its 40th anniversary of the release of the first movie, now known as Episode IV, A New Hope. Star Wars, as it was called at the time, was released domestically on May 25th, 1977. So, I'm going to introduce my guest this week. We have, and I'm really, really pleased to have been able to get these people for you, because they are experts, and, you know, I've been accustomed to getting my comic book experts, but to have two people who are so well-grounded and knowledgeable and credentialed in the area of music is just a real thrill for me. But we have Dr. Rachel Franklin, who is a musician, music lecturer, teacher. I could go on and on about her, but you can find out about her at her website. I'm going to ask her to shout that out when she comes on. And we also have Damian Wolf, who is a composer, and he is also the producer of a WERA show called Score and Song that you can hear every Sunday right here on WERA. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
That's a lot better.
Yeah,
okay. Hello.
I love to have my voice heard.
Well, and we love to hear your voice. This is really delightful. Now, I'm also supposed to have Mike Lunsford with Comics Online, but Mike was joining us via Skype, and for the life of me, I can't find Mike up here. So we're going to connect Mike, because I know he's very well prepared for this. We are going to connect him just as soon as we can. So, I'm a huge fan of music from, oh, that's basil polydorus.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's a cut from this. Dr. Franklin was just looking at the soundtrack to Conan the Barbarian, which aside, it's a very forgettable movie outside the fact that the soundtrack was pretty cool. Since there are most of the stuff is no words, I thought I would turn this on as background, which is why I was trying to find the right cut. But I expect that we're going to be able to play some music for you because I asked my panelists to prepare a couple of cuts that they thought were interesting or noteworthy. I think I will start out by, and I'm not going to put you all on the spot. I'm gonna name a couple of composers that I really like. And, you know, we talk about some people who are sort of noteworthy. I thought that we would get to some particular works that were sort of noteworthy. And since you all know about music, I thought that we might actually talk a little bit about the ins and outs of how music is composed, why certain pieces work with different types of productions, that sort of thing. So I thought that we would do that.
Sounds fabulous.
Well, thank you. You will be invited back.
only I say all the right things, yeah.
So, you know, now there are, of course, and actually, you know what? Since I'm talking about this, I'm going to just, and I'm going to do this because it's my show. I'm like, yeah, forget what I was going to play because I'm going to mention somebody else. And so, what the heck? It's a nice opportunity to play something from them. But Ron Grainer, who composed the theme to Doctor Who that is still in use, among other things. But he's done a lot of really great stuff. And there's some work of his from The Omega Man that I just thought was really good. So I'm gonna put that on in the background while we are going here. Anyway, actually, just the beginning of it, I'm going to bring up a little so the audience can hear this, because this is really, really beautiful music. And fit the work so well. Who are some composers that you all just like? Okay.
All right, ladies and doctors first.
There you go.
Do me a favor.
Rachel Franklin, please.
I'm just kind of in love with Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh,
right now.
Yes.
I really am. Yeah. I've been digging around because I know that you have a great interest in Jerry Goldsmith, and I do too. But I had been focused, obviously, more on Planet of the Apes, as you know, because I've been talking about it recently.
Yes, yeah, and the wonderful lectures that you were doing in connection with the Arlington Philharmonic.
Yeah, I had such a good time. I think we all had a good time, actually. But, of course, I have to come on your program, so I have to do more homework. And there is nothing like movie music homework. And just listening to the work that he did on The Alien, whether it was used or not, the Alien film, and some of the other films. I think Jerry Goldsmith is just right at the top of my list right now.
And, you know, I'm just going to stick on the end of that because Jerry Goldsmith is also one of my favorite composers. And in addition to his work on the various genre-related stuff, everything Jerry Goldsmith touches is fantastic. Patton, his soundtrack to Patton, is something else that stands out for me. But since that's not something we're talking about here...
No, but it's got the Echoplex thing. The magic box that I learned about. Apparently King Crimson liked to use stuff like that.
Oh, I'm a big fan of King Crimson, too.
It's my husband, yeah.
But I digress. Damien?
Well, I want to back up and say I am by no means an expert, although I do like to talk about film music a lot, so I can blab about it forever. It's, to me, film music, my show covers music in all sorts of media, whether it's film, TV, video games, etc. It's like learning a language. You never really stop. You're always learning, and I'm always discovering new composers. I mean, even this, what you're playing right now, this Omega Man, I've never heard this before. This is cool.
Oh,
you know,
goodness.
So you know, you're always learning stuff, you know. It's, so it's, to me, it's just it's part of the adventure for me. But I'm an equal opportunist when it comes to composers. I don't really have a favorite. And I think today's film music is so diverse in nature and instrumentation, texture, driven. It's all over the place. It's almost like sky's the limit in a way. And so I really like a lot. I love Jerry Goldsmith. I love, you know, Michael Giacchino. Mm. I love Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross.
Yes,
you know,
it's
and of course the list goes on and on. So
All right. Well, we have been joined by Mike Lunsford. Welcome, Mike.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah. Hi. Tell you what, man, I was a little nervous, and then this was something where just trying to connect with you here. So I'm delighted that we have actually got you on. So you probably heard some of what Damien was talking about. I was asking about, real quick, because we got a lot of stuff we're trying to get through here. Who are, just name one or two of the composers that you really like, you just love their work, or there's something that they've done that stands out for you?
Well, I wanted to definitely give applause to Dr. Franklin for her choice of Jerry Goldsmith, because I'm a huge Star Trek nerd, as you know, and like everything he touched on Star Trek was gold. I mean, the motion picture, Star Trek V, he did Generations, he did Voyager, he did First Contact, he did Nemesis. But I love him. I love Danny Elfman as well.
Yeah.
And
I love Danny Elfman.
And like, I'm surprised that nobody else has said it. I mean, maybe it's like,
well, it's the show just started.
Yeah, that's true. But John Williams, I think that John Williams is kind of the cream of the crop when it comes to it. You know, he's the Michael Jordan, if you will, of movie scores and soundtracks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, one of the interesting things about John Williams is he has been scoring for decades. I mean, as it turns out, it's some of his TV work that I really liked. I mean, he was among the last television composers to, virtually all the music in the old Lost in Space television series he did. And of course, he was Johnny Williams back then.
Well, I would debate that. I don't think he did the whole series, because I think other composers contributed as well.
They took so. In fact, what he really did, because there was the pilot for Lost in Space was more expensive than a lot of TV series. A lot of movies at the time. And they used all the effects stuff. I mean, they cut that episode up. They ended up using it in like the first six or seven shows, all the various effects stuff. But he had composed all the music for the pilot.
Right.
And they ended up reusing that throughout the 3-year run of the show. So, I mean, they did get other composers in.
Yep.
You know, I mean, and there was some other really good stuff that some of them did. I think I've got at least one cut. There's one called Family that and now that I've called the guy's name, I'm gonna have to actually see who did that. But it's a beautiful little piece, and they used it every time that Professor Robinson had to talk to one of the kids or something. It was just a very, you know, sort of homey thing. But yeah,
I also wanted to make sure that I didn't forget him, because he passed away about this time 2 years ago, another Star Trek alum, and that was James Horner. And he did Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, which has one of my favorite musical pieces of all time, when they're stealing the Enterprise and escaping from Earth orbit. Like, that's absolutely like one of my favorite scenes, and the music is what makes that scene. So.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm gonna and I like a lot of James Horner's work, and he's done a lot of stuff on stuff that I have liked, but I didn't appreciate how James Horner in that Star Trek II soundtrack, he kind of ripped off Bernard Herrmann, and I was like, wait a minute. I personally didn't appreciate that. I was thinking, now, you know, Mr. Horner, you are an accomplished composer on your own. You don't have to sort of sample from other people's work. But there, yes, I see Damien's like he's seething here. There was something that you introduced me to, and please, share this.
Well, I don't know the story behind that specifically, but I was watching a very similar situation recently, where somebody on YouTube had compared a lot of classical cues to John Williams, some of John Williams' cues, in which he is, you know, almost directly ripping off. Not saying stealing, but almost. And what happens with these guys when they're writing for film, a lot of times they're under deadline, and they're also at the mercy of the director. So if the director says, we want something like such and such or such and such, I'm not saying this happened with this particular case with James Horner or even with these John Williams things, but these things do happen from time to time. And so the composer is at the mercy of whatever the director or the deadline is calling for.
Well, that gets us straight into the tyranny of the temp track, doesn't it?
Ah, and see, Damien, that's where I thought you were going. Mm-hmm. But yes, so.
And what I'm saying, it can definitely apply to a temp track, but not necessarily all the time. I don't necessarily think that John Williams worked with a temp track, especially in the early days, working with Spielberg and George Lucas. But I think, again, you've got deadlines. You need to turn around. And in John Williams' case, he's got the writing and the orchestration to do in a very short period of time. And then getting it recorded and out the door. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know he worked a lot in collaboration with Spielberg, for example, and it could have been, I'm just taking a guess, and this may not be true at all, that Spielberg was like, I like this, this piece from The Planets, you know, and I love this whole piece. Can we do something like this? And John was like, yep.
It's funny that you mentioned the planets.
Mike, hold that thought just a second. I have to. No, it's okay. I have to remind everybody that they're listening to Fantastic Forum on WERA 96.7 FM, Radio Arlington. We are your community radio station, and we're talking today about music from various comic book, science fiction, fantasy, horror-related pieces. My guests are Mike Lunsford, Rachel Franklin, and Damien Wolf. And I'm sorry, Mike, you were getting ready to say.
Well, Damien had just mentioned, too, that The Planets by Gustav Holst was used as an inspiration for John Williams at one point. Interestingly enough, with Star Trek VI, when Nick Meyer was tagged to direct that movie, he wanted to use that. He wanted to use the orchestral suite, The Planets, but it was ridiculously expensive. So when he was listening to all the tapes that was submitted by the composers, he heard this guy, this 26-year-old kid, Cliff Eidelman, who did something very similar to that. And he was like, that's what I want. I want you to do this just like this. And that's one of my favorite soundtracks. And really after that, Eidelman really hasn't done anything really big like that ever again. It was kind of like almost like the one-hit wonder of movie scores.
Well, the other thing that Damien had mentioned that I wanted to get either, you know, Damien or Rachel to expound upon a little bit is this temp track thing, because I understand, and, you know, again, Damien, thanks for making me aware of this, but with the advent of nonlinear editing, where directors are able to sit in there with the editor and, you know, you do a rough cut of the film, and before the music is composed, they're putting stuff in just as like a placeholder. And then because they are so intimately familiar with it over this period of time while the film is initially being edited, invariably the director becomes enamored with what is the temp track, you know, this placeholding music that has been taken from other works. So, please.
Okay, I will plunge in, but one of the most famous temp track situations where the score was ditched was the score written by composer Alex North for 2001. He had been played music by Strauss, by Richard Strauss. Kubrick was enamored of Also sprach Zarathustra. And he said to North exactly what you were describing, compose it like this. So Alex North, who's a sensitive soul, you know, went away and sweated over it and created an entire score that, for all the world, sounds a lot like all the temp track, the classical temp tracks that Kubrick was using. And then North was not told that, in fact, Kubrick had ditched the entire score and he was going back to the classical music. And he didn't find out until the premiere. And it's very difficult because later on, Jerry Goldsmith himself conducted the original North score, and you can buy it, and I bought it, and I listened to the main title, and I played it right up against Also sprach Zarathustra, the Strauss one that Kubrick used. And the trouble is that the Strauss-Kubrick works, and there's no way you can extract your 2001 experience from the original classical work. And although North's work is fine, and it's clear that he's using the same type of instrumentation and the same brass and the same organ, unfortunately, it's not as good as the Strauss. And it's so unfair.
But is it not as good because because we're so used to that? We know that? Or is it not work as well with the story? Or we're so used to hearing the Strauss with the 2001? I don't know.
You know,
I'm just
I've got them both,
there.
Guys, so you just have to decide. Yeah, I can put them right up. I did this at the lecture.
There may be no answer
for
that. It's just
I asked audiences to put their hand up. There isn't an answer. There truly isn't. You know, I play them back to back, and you know, I talked about what we were used to and our experiences, and of course, most hands went up for Strauss, but a couple of hands went up for North. It's a very good piece. Had we not grown used, as you say, to the other, maybe we'd have liked it. I don't know. It's very unfair, and it happens a lot.
Well, I think the key is in terms of what is effective. Now, as a filmmaker myself, I'm excited about the opportunity that one has, because what you're doing is you're manipulating the audience. You control everything the audience sees and hears and experiences, and you use every bit of that to your advantage in terms of manipulating their emotions. Now, one of the things that I've been fascinated with in terms of, say, for example, and again, thank you, Damien, for this, because the Marvel movies, and these are Marvel now, this franchise has become the most financially profitable movie franchise in the history of the industry, which is saying quite a bit since the thing just started in 2006 with the first Iron Man film. And yet, there's a neat little video, and I'm going to have to probably share it on our Facebook page, where of all the familiar themes, you have people who can hum music from Star Wars and from Harry Potter and from any number of other seminal works. But you ask them to hum some music from the Marvel superhero movies, and they can't do it because the stuff is so incredibly forgettable. And what you have had, even though you've had some really good composers who worked on this stuff, they have not taken any risks in terms of the compositions that have ultimately been used. Now, I know a lot of that goes to the producers, a lot of it goes to the directors, but it's an opportunity lost. In this particular video that I had seen, they took a couple of different scenes with composed music, and then this, what do they call this stuff that they put in?
The tempura.
Yeah, but there was something even beyond that in terms of there was a particular way that they described this music that was taking no risks, sort of just kind of background music that was just forgettable. I mean, in fact, there was one scene from Iron Man where they played it with this background music, and then they took the background music out and the scene still worked. It neither added nor detracted anything from the film. And yet, you know, music should add. I mean, you should get a feeling from what you're listening to as it enhances the visuals. would any of you like to comment on this?
Let Mike go. He hasn't spoken in a while.
Mike, what do you say?
For the most part, I kind of agree that a lot of the Marvel stuff has been kind of forgettable. The one exception, I think, is the first Captain America, which was done by Alan Silvestri, who did Back to the Future. Yeah. He did Predator. He did Forrest Gump. Like the end credits for that one in particular was just like very rousing, and he did a great job of capturing that like very 1940s patriotic feel that you want with a Captain America movie. I was just thinking that the other day too, that most of these movies just don't have that, they don't grab you like they used to. When you think about Iron Man, for instance, like you mentioned, I don't think of any of the score. I think of AC/DC's Back in Black. I think of the actual like soundtrack, not the score.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's intentional, if they're trying to market it more for the younger audience, because that's, you don't see too many young people really gravitating towards the score. That's more of an older fans thing. And to go with the more popular music, seems to be a better way to catch. I'm not sure. I don't know what their focus with this one is, because now that Disney owns all this stuff, Disney loves doing soundtracks, man.
Yeah, well, their focus is play it safe and make a lot of money. That's their focus.
Yeah. You know, don't turn anybody off with that. Well, I tell you, as somebody who is particularly shallow when it comes to movies, and if I don't see it in the theater, no, really, you're laughing. Let me tell you why. I have found, quite shockingly, that I have not actually seen the entirety of a lot of movies. It'll come on cable. I'll happen to be flipping. I'll land on it. I'll watch it till the end. That happened to me today. I was watching Mother's Day. And it's like, I feel like I've seen it. I saw like the last 40 minutes of it. Oh, it's the important part. You know, whatever. Now, I haven't seen the whole movie. And later, I might see the beginning of it. I'm like, oh my goodness, I missed this. I mean, in some big movies, this has happened to me. I'm like, I didn't see the beginning of this. What are you kidding? But it gets so there are particular sequences that I like. And part of the reason I like these sequences is because they have been enhanced by music. You know, and, you know, okay, Captain America is a good example. There is a scene where, in the first Captain America movie, Captain America has rescued all these guys from the Hydra facility, and he's bringing them back, and the scene starts out, and, you know, General Phillips is, you know, real upset with, and now I can't think again. Mike, help me out here. No. Captain America's girlfriend, who was the...
Peggy Carter.
Yes, thank you, Peggy Carter. How could I forget that? So he's real upset, and he's raking her over the coals, and there's a commotion outside, and they come out, and here's Captain America leading all these guys back, and the music is, you know, dun, 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 you know, and then Cap comes up, and he's like, I'd like to submit myself for disciplinary action. Like, that won't be necessary, you know, but the music adds to all of this, you know, and you get this, you're like, yeah, this guy is really, he's a really good guy. He's just saved 200 guys, and yet he's offering himself up for disciplinary action because he went against orders and going to rescue him, you know. And the music should enhance that as opposed to just holding the place of that, you know.
Well, can I give a contrary to this too? Because I'll tell you one that you guys mentioned earlier, and I can't remember it, who it was that mentioned it, but Michael Giacchino is doing a lot of recent movies, and I would say, like, if there's anybody that's going to kind of grab the torch and run with it with the new, like, best composer to use, is him. He did the Rogue One soundtrack. That was not John Williams. Yeah, and now if you listen to, if you watch that movie, the music hits all the key points where it needs to, and it does amplify the emotion of the movie. I mean, he did that. He did Jurassic World. He's done all of the Abrams Star Trek movies, and I actually really like the music. Is one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the newer Star Trek movies.
Okay.
I think that he's one of the exceptions.
I'm no fan of those Abrams Star Trek movies.
I know.
Okay, you just had to bring that up, didn't you?
the music was good. Okay.
Actually, I love Giacchino's animated film scores. You know, I got a kid. You know, The Incredibles. That's one of the finest scores.
Right. He did that. Yeah.
The Incredibles is just amazing, and of course, there's the 4-minute weep on the floor. The silent movie at the opening of Up. You know, the couple and their marriage.
Oh, that's one of his too.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That's an absolutely exquisite little thing.
Now, this is somebody who knows how to tie music to the imagery. You know, I mean, you know, because I mean, now this the suite you're talking about from Up, that was masterful is the word that comes to mind, and as far as I'm concerned, that doesn't do it justice. But everything this guy does, because there's a cute little scene in, well, all of The Incredibles was really cute, but there's a scene where Elastigirl is telling the two kids, she's giving them the masks, and she's like, your secret identity is part of your protection. You've got to, you know, pretend. Mm-hmm. And even there, I mean, it's like, I'm just getting a little lump in my throat just thinking about that. Also the scene where Mr. Incredible's like, no, I'm not strong enough. I'm not strong enough to possibly lose you all. Like, I mean, it's just, and the music accentuates all that. You know, that's what music is supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to leave the theater humming this thing. I mean, I used to go out and I'd be running to buy these movie soundtracks. You know, I'm not doing that so much now. You know, but I don't know.
You're gonna play some?
you know, because I've been so into the discussion that it's time for us to take a break. But I was looking for the because I've got I've got the little musical cue. And I, well, you know, actually, I've got that now as part of the folder. I had to do this last week because I had somebody here engineering this. And so, what we are
I got to get you a Spotify account, Yuli. Like, seriously. Like, you can just set your playlist and you're good.
Yeah, well... I wish you would, because it would save me having to pull aside the curtain on a number of different occasions here. So anyway, WERA is a community radio station. We're non-commercial, and periodically it's appropriate for us to acknowledge the fact that we have those who underwrite and sponsor the content that you have come to know and love here on WERA. So we are going to step aside momentarily to acknowledge our sponsors and our underwriters, and we're also going to promote some other exceptional shows that you can hear this weekend on WERA. Shows like, oh, I don't know, Score and Song, Music and Film and Media, that comes on 3 p.m. on Sundays right here on WERA. So stick around, because we'll be right back with a lot more Fantastic Forum. And we're back here on Fantastic Forum. We are talking today about incredible, exciting, wonderful, emotion-inducing music from movies, television, productions of very genre-related things, horror, science fiction, fantasy, the whole nine yards. My guests are Rachel Franklin, Damian Wolfe, and Mike Lunsford. And Dr. Franklin was, because I had everybody prepare some music, and Dr. Franklin was saying, we haven't played any music. And I'm like, oh, but the time goes so much quicker when we play music. But we are going to play some music. It's some music that she has selected. And please set up this cut for us, please.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. How do I say it more bluntly? Humans are being hunted by apes on horseback with guns. You know, Charlton Heston and the remains of the crew are on what they believe is a foreign planet. We won't issue spoilers, even decades afterwards. And they see other humans, and they seem very primitive. Have they moved back in time? What planet are they on? And then there's a moment where they hear these strange sounds, and there's this swishing, and then these very primitive humans start running. And it's clear that they're being hunted by something, but you don't see what they're being hunted by straight away. And all of a sudden, out of these very high grasses emerge horses, and these apes on the horses, dressed in military gear with guns. And the music has been set up in layers, little cells, dun da 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 dun, dun, into little circular things that keep repeating, one on top of another, on top of another. Very modernistic technique. And then in the middle of that, you've got sound effects. And I think I mentioned this to you when I was here last, that there's a particular sound.
Yes.
Which is a shofar. With, you know, and again, I was just trying to imagine him trying to borrow a shofar from his local rabbi down at the synagogue there. And it's just an extraordinarily effective piece of orchestral writing. And it's so original. It's such a pleasure to listen to it. Mm-hmm.
Jerry Goldsmith.
Very good.
Indeed, you know. Yeah. And let's see if our listeners can tell when you first see the apes, because just listen to the piece.
We'll be right back.
Okay. All right. It's just yeah. All right. I'm gonna lower it, but I do want to hear the end of this. But this is such rich, powerful music, yeah. And you know, if this weren't radio, to where you could actually, and I encourage everybody, go watch 1968, 20th Century Fox, Planet of the Apes, because you know, outstanding film, and made only more so by Jerry Goldsmith's stirring soundtrack, but. And the acting's not bad either, but and the effects also, especially the makeup effects, which they really went above and beyond for.
Well, I don't know. If Roddy McDowall in that silly makeup. no, watch it for the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, there's something going on in modern filmmaking, and I'll be the bad guy if you know nobody wants to be. I'll be the bad guy. I don't like it because, you know, it's like I was saying. I used to be able to run out and acquire these soundtracks, and I'd play them over and over. I mean, I probably when I had vinyl of Star Wars, I mean, I played that. I mean, and not just Star Wars. I mean, there were other soundtracks to films that I went out, and I just, I mean, because I loved the music, and you don't find that as much anymore. Now, there was Danny Elfman had a quote that
okay,
you were
so
talking
I'm
going to
read this because it's mm-hmm. kind of funny when you think of Danny Elfman and the huge symphonic score that he did for Batman, which I thought was fantastic. But I just got this quote from 1990. He says, "I detest contemporary scoring and dubbing in cinema. Film music as an art took a deep plunge when Dolby Stereo hit. Stereo has the capacity to make orchestral music sound big and beautiful and more expansive, but it can also make sound effects sound four times as big. That began the era of sound effects over music. It's easier to let sound effects be big and just jump out and do everything than it is to let music do the same thing." Discuss.
he can afford to get away with saying that. Yeah.
What do you think, Damien? Yeah. I mean, you know, what is the largest score that you've been involved in?
You know, for me, it's not much because around here we have never have budgets for live players, so everything we're doing is all software based stuff. So the only live instrument stuff I did was when I was in school. But I think. I think what he's saying is basically, as we were talking off air, is that part of what's happening these days is in the dubbing stage of the film, which is when they go to do the audio mixing after the film is over. They're mixing the dialogue, the music, and the sound effects. Is that sometimes there's a big competition between the music and especially the special effects, and sometimes one has to take a dive over the other, or the sound effects are being used to replace music more and more, and you know it's. It's things change, things grow. It's not everybody's cup of tea, obviously, as in Danny's case, and I would agree with him to some extent as well. But it's the way modern commercial music has gone these
days.
But
it used to be an art to combine the sound effects and the score. I mean, I remember reading about is it Apocalypse Now? The evacuation scenes or something? I'm trying to remember. But where the music and the sound of the helicopters and the sound of the cars, and it's all kind of everything is a subscore of something else, and it's really elegantly combined.
Well, technology today is also much more advanced than it was. Even like listening to the Planet of the Apes, which is wonderful. Like you can tell it's an old score because of the way it was recorded. Not anything to do with the musicianship or the composing, but it's just because of the way it was recorded. It sounds old. You know, like if you listen to like Michael Giacchino or whatever we're talking about, you know, something modern day, it's going to sound much bigger, and everything is much more accessible, and the Dolby spread and this, well, we have 7.1 now in theaters or whatever.
I'll take your word for it.
You know, it's just a different era. I mean, and obviously, like I said, it's not everybody's cup of tea. I have mixed feelings about it personally, but it's just the way a commercial film is moved, unfortunately.
Well, I'm gonna give you my personal experience here because, you know, I've got this son and we've gone to these films many times. Mm-hmm. And before the film starts, of course, you know, we kill ourselves to get there on time. And of course, then there's like
20 minutes.
It feels like 40 of the temp track. It's literally, you're at the temp track. Mm-hmm. And they go around six or seven films of Inner World, you know, round and round. And everyone is.
Are you talking about the promos?
Yeah. And by the time you finished, every single one
right.
sounds the same. And, mm-hmm. you know, my son and I, we just look at each other and we just shrug. Can we remember any of the filmed promos we've just seen? No. All we know is we've just been blasted out of our chair by an identical set of temp tracks 7 times in a row. Pass me the popcorn. I've had enough.
Well, it wouldn't just, I'm sorry, respectfully, it's not really temp track use. It's trailer music.
Oh, well. Mm. But it could be. I mean, a lot of the trailer music right. tends to be temp track because they've put it out before the actual score is composed anyway.
Well, no, there's actually trailer houses that these things go to.
Oh, in which they, tell me more.
So they go to these trailer houses yeah. and they just have, you know, somebody set it up. And a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times it's drawing on library music.
Okay.
I mean, there's trailer houses where they specifically focus on trailer music for stuff and the big sound. Nowadays, the big thing, I don't know if you noticed it, I've been seeing at these previews is that they take some song, old song that we know,
yeah.
and it's usually just like a very long drone underneath it, and it's going really slowly, and there's a lot of reverb, and it's like, and it's supposed to be kind of the cool hip thing, but you know, yeah. after the second or third one, you're like, okay, I'm done with this, you know,
uh-huh.
and like yeah. you said, Rachel, it's just over and over and over misuse, yeah. you know.
Now,
so
when
they use yes. a lot of he was just mentioning, Damien was just mentioning. They will use, like, not canned music, but they'll use music from other movies to promo new movies
yeah.
because the score hasn't been finished. But, like, as you guys were mentioning, one thing, think about this. The Danny Elfman Batman soundtrack is iconic. Like, you still hum that in your head when you're thinking Batman.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody seems to think that The Dark Knight and all the Christopher Nolan ones were better. I can't hum any of the stuff that Hans Zimmer did for that movie.
Oh, you're going to get us all in trouble, Mike.
Oh, am I? Okay.
Well,
that's
okay.
called sacrilege. And I'm about to agree with you and commit it.
And who is this junkie
XL? I'm just saying that, you know, there's a lot of Hans people out there who are loyalists, you know.
I love the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack.
Right.
That was Hans Zimmer. And he's a genius, but that movie, those Nolan Batman movies were just so ho-hum. There was no, like, it's like it just droned on, and I was waiting for him to, like, hit a high note and really hit something powerful, and it just never happened.
Well,
just
but wait a minute, is it because the action is ho-hum? Oops, just got myself in trouble.
Well,
the one scene that I thought was effective in those Dark Knight films was what they did with the Joker. And check this out. Because I was sitting there and I was feeling all uncomfortable while mm-hmm. I was watching it. And the soundtrack, literally, it was just like a siren being cranked up. That's all it was.
Mm.
And he's, yeah, would you like to tell her how I got these scars? And the music goes,
can we get a repeat of that?
Is that the Nicholson one or is that
No, that's the Heath Ledger one.
It's brilliant, yeah. brilliant, brilliant.
Well, personally, I liked what Jack Nicholson did more, but we're not going to split hairs here. Everybody's got their opinion. But the soundtrack was this siren that they cranked up, and you know, there are a couple of scenes where they use it with the Joker, and I was feeling all uncomfortable. I mean, now that was effective. I mean, it was kind of, you know, I mean, and you know, you know what I'm talking about. You remember that?
It's mm-hmm. a very different approach. What they did is he took he brought a cellist into his studio, mm-hmm. and he just had him do a very, very slow ascending sort of drone thing where he just chromatically goes up the cello, and then and then in the studio they took it and they put effects and stuff on it. But and he wanted something that sounded like razors on a string is what Hans was trying to. And I admire him for that. It's not melodic by any means.
No.
But it was definitely very original.
Yeah, and effective.
And again, at the end of the day, this I'm going to sound like a geek here, I know, but you know, end of the day, the bottom line is it's all about story. You know, and if the music is helping tell the story, then that's what's most important, you know.
Yeah, because that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, and that's the subjective thing, too. You could put 100 composers in the same room scoring the same film, and they could all end up with something different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very subjective art.
Look at what Daft Punk did with Tron Legacy.
Yeah.
Tron Legacy, at best, is like a 5 or a 6 if you're rating it on a 1 to 10 scale of a movie. But that soundtrack is incredible.
Hmm.
Like, I think that lifts up the movie even more. Had you had like some generic cookie cutter soundtrack that sounds like every other movie out there, they probably wouldn't have been like a 3 or a 4, but their music was just so incredible for that movie.
Now you're going to make me go, because I don't remember anything of the soundtrack from Tron Legacy, so I'm going to, you're going to make me go get the soundtrack or play the soundtrack or something, you know, just to
It's actually really good.
That nerd. I have it on CD because I'm that. So yeah, I'll give it to you.
All right, now I'm gonna slam Hans Zimmer a little because now I for the most part I like.
Let me interfere and say I hope Kevin Sampson is not listening to this. All right, go ahead.
No, somebody had to hit me to this. But are you familiar with the Max and Dave Fleischer Superman cartoons? Mm-hmm. You ever heard that? Okay, all right. Well, I'll play the music from that for you, and then you listen to Hans Zimmer's Superman theme, and you tell me where he got it, because I tell you, he reached right back into what is now public domain stuff, and he lifted the key chords from that cartoon theme, and I was so hurt when I realized that.
And again, in all fairness to Hans, I mean, it could have been somebody who was behind the scenes going, this is what we want. It could have been, just to be fair about it, you know. So. Mm.
And I appreciate your impassioned defense of your colleague there.
I mean, I just like being fair. So.
He's incredibly talented. I don't think that by criticizing some of the output as just utterly generic, I actually don't feel that that diminishes the man's stellar talent. It's just that it's a treadmill, it's a lucrative treadmill.
And he is. I will say this about Hans. I mean, one of the things I admire about him, he's one of the composers that's reached a place in the composing community in Hollywood where he has the liberty to kind of go, this is kind of the sound I want to create.
Hmm.
You know, people are going to go to him more for his sound as opposed to bringing him on board to create something like this. You know, in Hollywood, especially, there are composers that have a niche, you know, and they have a sound or sounds, and they're go-to guys for that certain thing. I mean, going back to what we're talking about, say, for example, again, back to Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor, you know, you're not going to hear their kind of style of music in every film. It's not going to fit, but there are certain people who are going to go to them and say, you know, a certain niche group of filmmakers, we want this for our film, and that's what they do, and, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, I would hope that when you approach some composers, you know, there are guys who, you know, I think it's a shame. I wish there were more women composers that I was aware of in the industry. But you go to these guys because they have a certain stature, they have a name, they've done all this work, and you're like, hey, I want Jerry Goldsmith to do my picture. I want John Williams to do my picture or whatever. But now, can somebody tell me who this Junkie XL is?
I feel like I'm talking too much. No, Mike, do you want to weigh in on that?
Mike, who's Junkie XL? Do you know?
No, but I'm Googling it right now.
So well, then David, I think he got to start as actually a DJ in something like Denmark or Iceland, somewhere like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he became very popular, and he over time morphed his way into film music. And he did a lot of work early on with Hans as well.
Yes,
mm-hmm. And then he also does his own stuff, and he's just kind become niche.
Okay,
yeah.
I know who he is now. Now that I'm looking up all this music that he's done, he did all the stuff for Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh my!
And I thought that was an incredible soundtrack, and it just like completely slipped my mind. I was like, why? I didn't even look it up today in my research. So this one slipped through the cracks. But yeah, he does that. He does video game stuff. I mean, it just DJ is what he was known for. But he worked with Hans Zimmer in Batman vs Superman: Dawn of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was where I first saw the name, and I'm like, who is this guy?
He seems like a really cool guy. He's got a lot of videos online where he kind of breaks down his studio setup and what he's doing. I mean, for composers like me who are interested in that stuff, he seems like a very very accessible person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He did a remix of an Elvis Presley song, A Little Less Conversation, which if you heard the remix, you'd be like, oh, I've heard this song a million times. It's been in 1,000 commercials. Like, that's where he really got his big start in, like, 2002.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, look, we're down to our last couple of minutes, and I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to because ideally, people who have heard the show have gotten excited about some of the stuff that they've heard and are interested in finding out more about some of our panelists and, you know, being able to enjoy some of the other stuff they do. So
Dr. Franklin.
You've got to call me Rachel. I feel like silly here.
Right. Well, okay. So what's your website? Where can people find you? What are you doing
next? You can find me on rachelfranklin.com. It's a very old website, and this is the summer that I do something about that. But I am up there on rachelfranklin.com if you want to find me there.
Okay, and you just recently got done with a series of lectures for the Arlington Philharmonic. Anything else on the horizon like that?
Next year, I've got concertos and more lectures and lovely things like that. Yeah, I'm keeping pretty busy.
Okay, cool. All right. Damien, of course, people can hear you tomorrow at 3 p.m. on the WERA show Score and Song.
Right.
What's coming up there and what's coming up for you? Where can people find you? What's your website? All that good stuff.
I'm at, you can find out samples of some of my music at dwscomposer.com. And I'm currently working on a marketing video for a company in Pennsylvania. And I've also been doing a lot of podcast music lately as well. So I have actually just did a bit on a podcast yesterday. So I'm waiting to see if that gets picked up or not. But seems to be another market that's opening up for people like me is podcast music, writing custom podcast music.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's coming up tomorrow on Score and Song?
I do not know. It's either a repeat or somebody else. I don't know what's going on. I'm only live every first and third Sunday now.
I'm sorry. So, no, I didn't realize that.
Sometimes they play repeats. Sometimes I don't know if they are what their schedule is. But I've got so much going on. I had to kind of whittle down my schedule a bit. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's
because
okay.
It's a very entertaining show.
But it's a good thing he's got all the stuff going on.
Yeah,
indeed.
You know,
composers need
really,
stuff
it's
going on.
It's sleeping. That's a lot of those guys. Sleeping and eating.
Yeah. Hey, and Mike Lunsford, also of Comics Online and a variety of podcasty type stuff. What's up with you? Where can people find you and the latest stuff you're doing?
Well, if you want to read what I've written, the best place to do that is going to be comicsonline.com for everything. Geek pop culture, there's Comics Online. I've got all of my articles that I write there, but also the podcasts that I do for them are all going to be linked on there too. So if you just search my name, you're going to see all of the lovely and glorious things that I do as far as writing and podcasting goes. And I do have a separate podcast channel now that I'm working with another group. It's called Rock Deep Rogue Radio. I do that every Wednesday. I'm either doing a show called Real Life, which is our relationship show, or we're doing one called The News Feed, which is our current events sort of thing. But then there's always Comics Online podcast, and there's also Comics Online Pirate Radio. So I've got a lot of stuff out there.
Wow.
There you go.
Awesome.
All right. Hey, and I'd
busy
like
guy.
And I'm delighted. I want to thank all of our panelists, Rachel Franklin, Damien Wolf, Mike Lunsford, for coming on and for the scintillating and exciting discussion. Of course, Fantastic Forum is also a television show, and if you're here in the Arlington area, you can catch us tonight at 8. It's an all-new episode that's running. So, tune in and check that out. It's Comcast Channel 69, Verizon Fios 38, Arlington Independent Media. And you can always find us at fantasticforum.tv. And please come back next week. We're going to be talking Wonder Woman. So same bat time, same bat station.